WHYFM.
This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. There are an estimated 2,400 shipwrecks which lie beneath the surface of the ocean off the Jersey coastline, a stretch once known as the graveyard of the Atlantic. Many of them contain artifacts, some of which are treasure, making New Jersey a diving destination. It's not just the Caribbean. And later this hour, we'll talk to a sculptor who sinks his extraordinary work to form coral reefs, which are endangered in many parts of the world. But first, wreck diving in New Jersey waters. In studio with us is Tina Held, instructor of marine studies at the Marine Academy of Technology and Environmental Science, or the Mates Academy, in Manahawkin. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Thank you.
You're also a New Jersey wreck and master diver. And also joining us on the phone is Dan Lieb, president of the New Jersey Historical Divers Association and a wreck diver himself. Nice to have you along, Dan.
No, thanks.
So I'm going to guess that most of us, when we head to the shore for the day or vacation, we're not looking out at that ocean and imagining the rich history that's lying under the water. Sketch the landscape for us, would you, Tina?
Yeah, well, you know, teaching at the Marine Academy, we know the landscape very well out of the water. When I was a kid, that was one of the things that really interests me. I would walk the beaches, and we would find, like marine life or evidence of marine life, but occasionally we'd find artifacts and that were not biological. So it really interests me. And then I started exploring that there are ships that actually would come on land and be buried. So it kind of, if you now walk from the coastline and you were to walk into the water and put a mask on and go into the water, you'd be surprised that not only would the landscape under the water look like it does on land, but occasionally you'd come across different substrates or bottom consistencies. And every so often it would be something that wasn't natural and it would be a shipwreck. So, and then if you keep venturing off into the water into, you know, deeper realm, it would look the same as it does on land, but we would come across, again, some of these other landscapes that would be shipwrecks, and you can keep going. So it looks the same on land, just put water on top of it.
And as we mentioned, there's a really, a lot of history to this. Mm-hmm. Dan Lieb, let's look first at the Ella Worley, which is a Civil War era steamship that sank in the waters about 5 miles off Belmar. What was that, a century and a half ago?
Just about.
And a Florida diver found it not too long ago, and he claimed it. He claimed the whole ship?
Actually, yes. He arrested it in federal district court. He did what was called an admiralty arrest. And he speculated that the vessel had some wealth still aboard. It was reported that the vessel had sunk with about $13,000 worth of gold at the time. About $5,000 was believed to be recovered, leaving about $8,000 on the bottom. Today, that would be close to $1 million worth of value. So it would be well worth going after.
So let's roll it back just a second. What happened to her? Why did she sink? Do we know?
Well, the Ella Worley was involved in a collision with another vessel and nearly cut in half and sank to the bottom. It had on board a personal transfer of wealth and a government transfer of wealth.
So
believe that the, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was the government transfer that was recovered.
So when somebody like this Florida diver, Alan Gardner, finds something like this and he claims it and he goes to court, is it really finders keepers, or do you have to work your way through a process before you can actually stake a claim?
Well, that it's the latter is the truer part of that. Anything that is lost off the coast was manufactured and built and bought by somebody, so somebody owns it. Whether or not it is the property of the line that was carrying it, like a boat or a company that was carrying it, or the insurance company that filed the claim and then paid it off, somebody owns something out there. But when we divers go out there and we find like a brass spike that held a board to a frame, or we find a broken piece of pottery, nobody's going to really, you know, squawk about something like that. But if you come across about 30 or 40 silver bars on the bottom weighing about 80 pounds each, you could have whole governments come out of the woodwork staking claims to your find.
So you have to claim that, I guess.
Yes.
Or do some people have them squirreled away in an attic someplace?
Yes, you go through a process called an admiralty arrest, mm-hmm. and essentially what you're doing is you're arresting the wreck, you're charging it, so to speak, and the court is defending it. And if nobody comes forward, an insurance company or a previous owner, if nobody comes forward and says, hey, that's mine, then what the court can do is award salvage rights to you and eventually ownership.
Tina, I see you nodding your head.
I get excited when Dan himself, and he knows how it feels when we do find some of those artifacts, those individual pieces, because the history just comes to life in your hands. And, you know, the ship was on the top of the water, and as it sunk, you know, now becomes a skeleton because the marine life kind of break it down. And all of those artifacts that kind of go down with it, personal items in most cases, you know, they find their place either buried, and as the water shifts, it uncovers. So every time we dive, it's always a different dive as it changes. So that skeleton changes, and every so often we'll pick up that brass spike that he's talking about, or that piece of pottery or bottle, and it's exciting, or a sword sheath. And you think to yourself, wow, they ran around with swords on this ship, this vessel. It's exciting.
So let's paint the scene. Let's set the scene for New Jersey diving, because many people, I think, you've got the image of diving in the Caribbean and going, you know, along the coral reefs and seeing the fish. In New Jersey, and I'm a diver myself, the water is not as murky as you might think it is.
No.
Paint it for us, if you would, Tina. When you get off, you go out on a boat for most of the dives, and you splash in, and what do you see?
Well, we always ask, hey, what's the viz for the first person in?
And sometimes visibility.
Visibility, that is, or an acronym for it. And sometimes on the surface, it's amazing, and then you'll hit something called the thermocline, which is where the temperature changes. And you got to figure, in New Jersey, our bottom consistency is not solid like coral reefs and limestone structures. So the bottom is more silty or sandy. So sometimes the water movement under will stir up the water. So the bottom might not be as visible as if you're in the coral reefs. The other thing is the bacterial, or not the bacterial life, but the planktonic organisms that live in the water in New Jersey give that brown and green appearance. It's healthy. It's good. In the corals, when you're in the tropical water, all of those things are living in and being filtered and living in the corals. They live symbiotically together. So the water seems clearer there, and the bottom is a different structure, so it doesn't stir up. But the visibility in New Jersey would surprise a lot of people.
And the temperature.
Let's not forget the temperature. Right
in
now,
in the middle
cold.
Of the summer, it's probably still...
Well, the surface is warm, but when you drop below that thermocline again, the bottom maintains a consistent cooler temperature, shall we say. But it's still, we wear more protective gear for that. You know, it's definitely more gear intensive, but it's very rewarding, and it's always different and exciting. So it's cool.
We're talking about scuba diving, and in particular wreck diving off the Jersey coast. Give us a shout at 888-477-9499 if you dive, if you're interested in learning about diving, or you can shoot us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's talk about when you get into that water and you approach a wreck. And Dan, I'd like you to jump into the conversation here, because it's not, it takes a skill. It takes skill to dive a wreck. You can get stuck in a wreck. You have to undergo special training to go into a wreck, correct? Dan, you want to address that?
Yes. One thing I wanted to just chime in about was about visibility. I think it's important to note that we have a couple of major rivers in this area. Nothing as big as the Mississippi, but the Delaware and the Hudson River are major rivers, and they do put a lot of nutrients into our waters, and organisms in that water live off those nutrients. If you bear in mind that the major commercial fishing in the United States and in the world occurs mostly in colder water, not really in warmer, more placid waters, but in the North Atlantic, North Pacific, South Pacific, this is where the big commercial fleets go. That natural turbidity of the water is what gives us our visibility. Sometimes it can be very dirty after you get a storm and you get a lot of runoff. Mm-hmm. You can have very, very muddy water. Otherwise, if the visibility is, I don't know, Tina, we usually get visibilities averaging about 20 feet on a good day.
Yeah, 20, 25 feet, which is great, actually.
We dive in the tropics. You dive in a blue world, in an azure world. We dive here in an emerald world.
So is there a large wreck diving community in New Jersey, would you say?
I'm going to say we probably have about 10,000 wreck divers. That's the last figure I heard, was about 10,000, but I'll bet it's higher than that. And there's various training that you can go through. You can go through a basic open water course, which will allow you to go out and get experience.
So when you train, when you train, Dan, what is the most dangerous part of wreck diving?
When you train?
When you train, what do you need to learn to avoid the most dangerous situations?
Well, every time you hear people talk about diving, they always eventually get to the soda bottle example. If you stay down too long, your tissues, your blood will absorb the nitrogen that we normally cast off freely. And if you stay down too long, you build up a lot of nitrogen in your system. And if you come up too quickly or if you don't come up in stages, it can come out of your system in the form of bubbles. It can get into your heart, your brain, your spine.
The bends.
And it can kill you. It can cause the bends.
Mm-hmm.
And divers are taught to avoid that. They're also taught not to hold their breath. And if you're in a panic situation, you turn around a corner and you see a big shark and you go, oh my God, there's a shark, you might be inclined to panic a little bit and want to go up to the surface too quickly. Divers are taught slow down, think, breathe.
So you can't pop up to the surface, but what are you going to do when you see that shark?
Oh,
be excited.
People,
I would be excited.
Well, that's somebody who works in marine biology.
I've always had a deep respect for sharks, but whenever I come across marine life, I always think, oh, I'm going to panic when I see something big. I'm usually struck with a little bit of awe and fascination, and if I keep a respectable distance, I can sit back and just enjoy nature.
Well, I know, Tina, you did some diving with great
whites.
Well,
real quick, I just wanted to interject. I think one of the biggest hurdles with, and Dan, you could probably attest to this, with our diving, you know, people know that we carry knives. We're not Rambo divers, and it's not to fight off sharks or anything like that if we come across them. But we carry knives because one of the biggest, I think, dangers in New Jersey diving is those same shipwrecks that we dive to collect marine life and see marine life. They're a habitat. So fishermen also are using that same shipwreck to collect fish and do what they do best. So they cut their lines. So one of our biggest dangers, I think, underwater is being entangled in monofilament, we call it, or fishing line, which you can't break. I mean, that's the whole idea with fish. You're not going to snap it. So we carry knives and tools so that we can, you know, help ourselves and, you know, untangle if needed or cut out. So I think that's probably one of the biggest hurdles with our diving.
That's an excellent point because over the years, Tina and I, we've dived wrecks for 25, 30 years in these waters, and we've actually watched them fall apart.
Oh, yeah.
There's one wreck off our coast called the Seagirt wreck. We've watched the rudder of that wreck move halfway around the wreck and then jump inside the hull.
Yeah.
It's got to weigh a ton. It's commercial fishing practices that are doing that. Now, these guys are probably not into the idea of losing tens of thousands of dollars worth of fishing gear. Our area is overfished. It is stressed. But occasionally, a boat will get too close to a wreck. Some pot lines will get tied up in it.
Dan, I'm going to have to jump in right here. We're coming up against a break. Dan Lieb is president of the New Jersey Historical Divers Association. Tina Held teaches marine studies at the Mates Academy in Manahawkin. Our number to call is 1-888-477-9499. We're exploring New Jersey wreck diving, diving off the coast on Radio Time. Stay with us.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org. Before you hit the polls on primary day, tune in to WHYY's Election 2014, Friday at 11 a.m., hosted by WHYY's Dave Davies and featuring reports from across the state. WHYY's Election 2014 is a comprehensive look at the Pennsylvania congressional and gubernatorial races, focused on the issues that matter to you: taxes, education, fracking, and more. WHYY's Election 2014, Friday at 11 a.m.
I'm Robin Young. A young man from war-torn Africa turns wine glasses into song for solace and goes viral.
I was like, I'm going to be happy in the moment right now and do something and share some happiness.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about wreck diving. Dan Lieb is president of the New Jersey Historical Divers Association, and Tina Held teaches marine studies at the Mates Academy in Manahawkin. She's a master diver and a wreck diver, as is Dan. If you'd like to jump into the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-477-9499. You know, we talked a little bit at the beginning of the show, Dan, that there are an estimated 2,400 shipwrecks, and this area off the Jersey coastline was once referred to as the graveyard of the Atlantic. Why is that? Why so many wrecks?
Well, the reason that we have so many wrecks in this area is we've got the major ports of Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. In particular, we've got Long Island to the north and the Jersey Shore to the west, and it creates kind of a funnel. You've got three major shipping lanes that converge in this area, and the weather, and when the weather is foul, sailing vessels in the 17 and the 1800s often fell victim to those storms by piling up on the beaches. In the 1900s, not only did they collide with each other during storms, but they were also sunk due to enemy action during two world wars.
Yeah, and I didn't realize, I know Marty did a show on this a few years back, on the story of a World War II German submarine whose wreckage was discovered in the 90s off the coast. You know, my generation, I didn't realize they got that close to us.
Yeah, very often my parents would tell me, particularly my father would tell me about blackouts along the Jersey Shore and headlights being painted, the top halves being painted black to allow as little light as possible to get offshore to allow marauding U-boats to see silhouettes of passing ships.
Wait, and also this one particular submarine, which is U-boat 869, divers discovered it, and it was, I think it was in over 200 feet of water, and we'll talk about how you dive that deep in a moment, but there were the remains of the German submariners on board this vessel, and what are the rules when you're diving? Because I imagine that, you know, in some of the more recent wrecks, you're going to find that. Well, how do you treat that, and is there a law regarding that?
There is a law regarding that. As far as international law is concerned, all military vessels that sunk with loss of life are war graves, and they should be respected as such. It's up to the individual nations to enforce that as they see fit.
So, but as far as artifacts that are taken off, if you dive a wreck like that, can you go in there and just avoid where the remains are and then look for the artifacts, or how do you handle that?
It's best to err on the side of caution. If I were involved in a situation like that myself, I would probably avoid taking artifacts. There are other wrecks to dive.
Tina, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree with him. I agree with him on that.
Yeah, definitely. I know the divers who were working so hard to identify the vessel respected that, but they just felt they had to identify the vessel and kept going back and back and back to try to find some sort of identifying
piece. Yeah, a lot of
piece.
Times it's the art. Well, Dan can tell you this. It's the artifacts that will give you the true indicators of the vessel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, captains, some of the wrecks that we dive have numerous names to them. First, they're just the spot, and then the spot becomes a name that the captain calls it because we don't know what it is. And then over time, the name changes until something like artifacts are coming up that identify exactly what the vessel, not exactly, but it helps indicate as data what that vessel's name may or may not be.
A good example of that is a wreck down in South Jersey off Atlantic City called the $25 wreck.
Oh, yeah.
It got the name when a dive boat captain purchased the location from a fisherman for $25.
Huh.
So for years, the name stuck, the $25 wreck.
Yep.
And then sometimes they don't even purchase information. There are boats that are ready to jump a claim.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
You don't win any friends doing it that way, but that does happen. So there's some competition out there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about diving again in extraordinarily deep water. That is not for the average recreational diver. How deep, first of all, is safe for the average recreational diver, Tina?
You're not going to want to go beyond about 130 feet or so. And even that, it's not just a walk in the park. I think on average, most recreational divers are going to be within about 90 feet of water. And there's plenty of shipwrecks in, you know, 50 to 90 feet of water. When you start doing some of the deeper dives, you're going to start, you know, you're looking at that decompression, and you have to do these decompression stops and hanging, and it's more of an experience type diving.
So as you're coming up from the wreck, you actually have to take it very, very slowly so the nitrogen actually comes out of your tissues and doesn't bubble up, and then so you don't get the bends.
Absolutely.
A number of people actually died on that expedition to discover the U-boat 869.
Yeah, but there are books about that.
Yes, yes. We do have a call from Christina. She's standing by. Christina, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about... I used to go down to Barnegat Light when I was a little kid, and there was a wreck off of the end of our street. I was on 11th Street. I don't know if that means anything to anyone, but there was a wreck in the surf, and when, at low tide, we used to swim through it and just kind of hang around. There wasn't a whole, you know, like a part of it was sticking up, and the mast, you could always see the mast.
Dan?
It depends on how far south of Barnegat Light it actually is. That strip of that island has a number of beach wrecks along it. There was a wreck that I invested with some archaeologists a couple of years back that was a little bit south of Barnegat Light, opposite a siren. I think it was a hurricane siren or a tidal wave siren. We used to call it the siren wreck. And that it could be that, I mean, I don't know how many years you're talking about, but it could have been back at that time that parts of the wreck could have stood up above the surf.
Christina, you still there? Okay, thank you very much for the call. Let's look at the Robert J. Walker, Dan, which is a steamer which collided with another ship back in 1860 off the coast of Atlantic City. That's now listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it'll be mapped. You're taking part in that, right?
Yes, I'm leading an expedition of divers to go out there this August to map the site.
So first of all, how deep is it?
About 85 feet. Not terribly deep.
And what does mapping involve?
Literally going down there with tape measures and slates and plumb bobs and measuring rods and literally mapping it out. Like if you had a surveyor going out there and mapping your property because you want to put an extension on the house, they want to know where the sidewalks are, they want to know where the fence is, the house is, lamp posts. We want to know where the boiler is, where the bow is, where the anchor is. We want to know where all the major features of the wreck are today.
So is this so recreational divers can actually have some sort of thing to follow when they go through it, or is it just for government record?
No, it's actually for both. It will be for government records. It's always good to have the information as to what the wreck's state was at the time of the mapping. We know what the wreck looked, we know what the vessel looked like when it sank, and we'll know what it looks like today, so we'll know how long it took to get into the condition that it's in. But also what we'd like to do is, well, I know what NOAA would like to do. They would like to make sure that divers get a chance to visit the site. They don't want you taking anything from it because it is a National Register site. But what they're hoping is that divers will acquire these slates, these little road maps, so that they could go down and visit each of the features and understand what it is that they're looking at.
What are some of the more famous wrecks that are out there under the water off the Jersey coast? If you're sitting on the beach and you're looking out and you want to use your imagination on a lazy summer day.
Tina, do you want to take a swipe?
Well, I don't know if I would. You'd probably be better off saying if they're famous or not. I can tell you what wrecks that we commonly dive and we enjoy diving and why we enjoy diving them.
Okay, go for it.
Some of the wrecks that we enjoy diving, some of the more common ones off of New Jersey at least, you know, I can name a few, like something called the Amarante, which at one time was called the flower wreck. Again, I told you we have slangs for them because it was carrying flour.
Mm-hmm. And how old is that one?
That Dan, what do you say?
I believe
early 1900s?
If I'm not mistaken, I thought it was a World War I wreck.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then also like another wreck called the Great Isaac, which is a wreck that's been split and sits on its port side. Most of the wrecks that we dive, we're looking, as a wreck breaks down, like I said, it was a skeleton, you get the marine life, which is my, you know, expert area. You get, you know, your furled anemones and your teredos, which are like mollusk-boring shipworms. And what they do with the wood, they break it down into bits and pieces and nooks and cracks and crevasses. or oxidizing of the steel and iron hulls and plates that actually break a wreck down. So as a wreck breaks down, it changes its shape, and it creates new little gaps in substrate for marine life. So we, I don't know if we want to call them famous dives as much as we like to dive them for collecting lobster, spearing fish, scallop, you know, like different types of mollusks that we might collect, like mussels.
So you can go out and you can actually dive your dinner.
We do dive our dinner, yeah. Mm. I mean, I enjoy artifacts and looking for artifacts and the history. I love it all. But we also come back and we do. We're out hunting our dinner and bringing back food. Yeah.
We touched on this.
New Jersey's amazing for it.
We touched on this just a little bit ago about diving and that you had actually gone diving with great whites. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while you hear one of those creatures kind of coming up. Not too often, though. There's not really. Is there anything dangerous off the Jersey Shore?
Well, you know, New Jersey and Long Island Sound, it's one of the breeding grounds for juvenile great whites. So we do have great whites, but that's something that is rare in between. And in most cases, if a shark does come in, they're more curious about you. And they might come in and peek and kind of disappear. So you might not even see or know they're even there. In other waters, I did dive great whites purposely to film great whites out on the Pacific West Coast. So there were lots. They go there to feed.
And when you do that, you're in a cage.
Well, yeah. No? With this particular situation, we did have cages, but there were also just platforms in filming. So in some cases, there are no cages. It's just you're kind of levered down in the water in a platform and standing on a platform. And the sharks come right up, and you use your camera to kind of just pop them away.
And you can pop them away, and that works.
Yeah.
They don't scent you or think you're looking yummy. Or
yeah, they're not stupid. I mean, you know, you have to figure they're curious. And unfortunately, with a shark, when we're curious, we use our hands and we touch things. Sharks, when they're curious, they have their mouth, and that's what they use for curiosity. So when they're coming up to you, they're more curious, and if you're going to give them some kind of pop on the nose or something, they're not stupid. They're going to sense fear, and they're going to go away. They're not going to try to come at you.
So one more quick question while we're on that topic. If anything were to happen, do they just raise you really quickly? Or?
Well, they'd have to raise you really slowly, yeah.
That's right. Quickly. It depends on how far down you are.
Exactly.
Dive at your own risk.
Absolutely. But it's amazing. So
I'm sure it is. Not for every diver, but I'm sure it is. All right, Dan, a couple of New Jersey divers, talking about an exciting find, who found the bridge bell on the Andrea Doria. That wreck is in 240 feet of water. So when you go down that deep, do you have to use special equipment? I mean, can you actually physically dive that deep?
Yes, you can. I mean, you can dive even deeper. A lot of divers now that are venturing into water that deep are doing what's called technical diving, where what they're doing is they're bringing a lot of gases with them, special mixtures. In the old days, we just brought a lot of air with us, and we dive the regular Navy decompression tables. Now we use computers, we use specialty blends of gases, and we have gases that are even hung from the boat that can meet us on our way up.
Mm-hmm. What have you found yourself as far as treasure is concerned? What is something that you absolutely love that you discovered, Dan?
Well, I like to think that what I found is a treasure of knowledge. I mean, I found a few bits and pieces of shipwreck, some brass items, some wood items, even iron items that we've managed to preserve in our shipwreck museum over in Wall. But to me, it's a treasure of knowledge. It's finding an artifact with a patent on it or a manufacturer's name or even a ship's name, and then researching the history and bringing it to light, sharing it with the public.
Tina?
I love the knowledge as well, Dan, but nothing, I love finding artifacts. I think one of my favorite pieces is my compass or a binnacle that I had found kind of on an accidental find on a ship that I didn't have any tools or anything like that day, but it was sort of a beautiful visibility. It was one of those 80-foot visibility days, very rare in New Jersey, and I had an opportunity to swim off the shipwreck and had my hand in the sand and just kind of found a binnacle or a compass. So it was really exciting, but more so because my father and I restored that. My father's no longer with me, so it's a memory
that's special.
I share. Yeah, so it's probably my best.
So is there a place, Dan, if our listeners wanted to head out someplace and see some great collection of historical artifacts that were pulled in from the Jersey coastline, is there some place like that?
Well, there are two great museums. There's one in Beach Haven called the New Jersey Maritime Museum, run by Deb Whitcraft. It's a wonderful museum. And we have our museum, the New Jersey Shipwreck Museum, at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall. So at one end of the coast and at the other end, there are two very, very good maritime museums with a lot of shipwreck information. But there's also Tuckerton Seaport, which focuses a bit on shipwreck history. There's a little bit there. There's also the Toms River Seaport Museum as well. Okay. So we've actually got a lot of maritime history preserved in this state.
If somebody were interested in getting into diving, Tina, you and I were talking about this off air. It's a fascinating sport. Once you're into it, you can see an entirely different world. But it is not cheap.
No, not at all.
It's unfortunate. Let's talk about it a little bit. I mean, if you're going to be certified, I know when I did it, and it was gosh, over 20 years ago, I took a classroom course, and then I went into a pool, and then I did my diving test in a quarry, a very cold quarry with one fish. I don't know where that fish came from. But it cost me a chunk of change for somebody who is a young single woman. So.
Yeah, it does consist of, because you have to figure it's not the safest sport. You want to be trained appropriately so it is safe for you. It starts in a controlled environment. That controlled environment would be your classroom and pool session. Then you go to open water, we call that, and that open water, that quarry that you are in, is a somewhat controlled environment as well. Mm-hmm. Open ocean is not a controlled environment. Anything can
happen.
You've
got the currents.
Yes, currents, winds, waves, cold water, salt water is also a concern. People are uncomfortable with salt water, not as much with fresh water. Mm-hmm. So that the course itself costs quite a bit, and then you figure you have to rent gear or purchase gear. And then when you have the gear, if you purchase it, it has to be maintained. And then to go diving, to go on a charter of a boat if you don't have a boat of your own. So in the long run, it's not the cheapest sport. Mm-hmm. But I guess skiing isn't either, right?
Sure. And Dan, if somebody wanted to start diving wrecks, how would you advise that they begin?
I would always advise that if you're interested in diving, visit a shop that's closest to your home, because that's going to be the most convenient to you. And if you want to learn to dive anything in the area, whether it be an outcropping on the bottom or a shipwreck or diving around jetties, join a club.
Yeah.
And you can get that information through a dive shop.
Yes, definitely.
Are there any starter wrecks, you think, that are particularly good for beginners?
You know, a lot of people often think about shallow wrecks as being easy to get to. They're right off the beach. I don't know. It's a lot easier to step off a boat into nice, clear water than it is to walk in through 2 and 3 foot surf. I mean, I've known Andrea Doria divers that have walked into a beach, that have walked into the surf to get to a beach wreck and badly twisted their ankle.
And these are the guys who went 240 feet down to get that bell.
That's exactly correct.
I think diving, we usually, for newer divers, will put them on more of what we call an intact shipwreck. Like I told you, the wrecks break down. When it's an intact shipwreck, it's easy to navigate. You don't get lost. The visibility is usually a little better.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to have to switch gears as we head into the final portion of the hour. We've been talking about wreck diving. Our guest, Tina Held, instructor of marine studies at the Mates Academy in Manahawkin, and a wreck diver. A pleasure.
Thank you.
And Dan Lee, president of the New Jersey Historical Divers Association. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Up ahead, artist Jason DeCares-Taylor joins us from the Canary Islands in Spain to talk about his underwater sculpture park. Stay with us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Muscawayne.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. WHYY is beholden to you. Informing you is our top priority, and that also means being available on air and online. We know that many of you listen to WHYY.org at some point during the week. Let us know you value this service by clicking over to the support page and making a pledge. We will invest your contribution right back into the services you expect from us. WHYY.org. Thank you very much.
a world dependent on electrons.
Nothing is smaller, faster, or lighter than electrons. For countries that want to develop, they have to have electricity.
Author Robert Bryce likes things that are small, fast, light, dense, and cheap. The key ingredients, he says, for a rational global energy future. But what are the trade-offs? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Jason DeCares Taylor is an eco-sculptor and diver. He created the world's first underwater sculpture park in the West Indies, and it is now listed as one of the top 25 wonders of the world by National Geographic. If you're listening and you're able to do this, you might want to check it out at whyy.org/radiotimes. We've created a great slideshow. Jason DeCares Taylor, welcome to the show.
Hello. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. You're calling us. We're talking to you from the Canary Islands in Spain. This is exciting. First of all, I wasn't sure, Jason, what I would find when I looked at the pictures, but oh my gosh, some of these underwater human-like sculptures, I'm trying to find the adjectives to describe them. Beautiful, otherworldly, absolutely spectacular.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes. I mean, I've been working on it for the last kind of 8 years, so it's been a quite intense period, having almost completed, I think, over 600 works now.
Let's start at the beginning. So where did this idea come from?
Well, actually, I trained in sculpture back in London in the early 90s, and my work was always focused on land installations and creating sort of pieces that would go onto the landscape and around forests and rivers. And then I sort of finished my degree, and I had made all these sort of collections of pieces, and I kind of felt a little bit disillusioned that I then had to sort of store them in warehouses, and I was living in London, so it was very problematic. And it kind of sort of put me off going into art for a little while, and I sort of went off and did some other different jobs. I trained as a photographer, and I did some different kind of stage design. And eventually I sort of wound up becoming a dive instructor in Australia. And so I sort of spent a few years teaching people, and eventually I sort of started to think about this idea of, you know, using these works for underwater and then creating these artificial reefs. And it kind of brought a new kind of functionality that sat better with me.
So scientists are saying we've lost 40% of our reefs. Is that where you were going with this?
Certainly. I mean, actually, after Australia, I moved to the Caribbean. And in the Caribbean, I think there's almost 80% of coral reefs have been lost or threatened. So certainly, I was very, very motivated to try and offset that somehow.
Tourists who get too close to reefs, and when you dive, you want to see everything close up, but unfortunately, when you handle them, you can ruin them.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, reefs are on the sort of forefront of many different things, not just sort of tourism impact. There's also overfishing, which is one of the main things, because the fish actually graze a lot of the harmful algae that are on the reef. So providing a sanctuary for fish is also equally as important. And of course, there's what the, you know, global warming, a host of different problems. But by making artificial reefs, you kind of draw the visitors away from these natural areas and kind of sort of create a habitat area, create a space for corals to grow and also for, you know, fish to live in.
So back to your sculptures, they are human-like. And how do you come up with the models?
Well, the process is all based on live casts. So I always take a living person and then bring them to the studio and then live cast them in a special type of plaster and alginate. And then from that, I go on to make a sort of marine cement cast. And then that will be the piece that actually goes underwater.
And that actually attracts the marine life, the marine cement cast?
Yes, yeah. The surface of the sculpture is pH neutral, so it allows for sort of coral polyps to adhere to and then start to grow. And corals basically sort of rain down in a snow, you know, in the water column. And if they touch anything hard or stable, then they'll actually start to grow. So the, you know, the sculptures offer that kind of platform.
So back to the models, in looking at the pictures, they are from all walks of life. Do you just you know, ask somebody on the street if they're interested in posing? Do you go to certain areas of the world or neighborhoods to try to produce a particular image?
I sort of go all over the place. I try to sort of cover a cross-section of different people and age groups and nationalities. But generally, I have to say that, you know, I tend to pick most of the models in my local area. And I can be sitting in a breakfast bar or waiting for a bus, and, you know, I see someone that has particular features or particularly interesting lines, and I have to go up to them and then explain to them this really crazy process. And yeah, I get turned down a lot, but sometimes people are brave enough and they come back.
And so when they sit for you, then what is the what are you trying to convey in some of these scenes? Let's look at one of them. Let's talk about the silent evolution, for instance. What is the message that you're trying to get across? Paint the picture.
Well, obviously, the silent evolution is one of the biggest installations I've created. I think there's over 450 sculptures comprising it. And it's meant to be this sort of monumental artificial reef, this mass grouping of people kind of living in symbiosis with nature and actually sort of adding something to the environment instead of taking something away. And for that, I was actually in Mexico at the time, and I searched for sort of hundreds of different models to add into it. And currently, I think it's been there for 4 years, and yeah, we're seeing some really good growth starting to be attracted.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking to eco-sculptor Jason DeCares-Taylor. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. In looking at this, in looking at the silent evolution, the faces are not necessarily smiling. They seem to be solemn. Am I correct? Are you trying to tell us something with that? Or are some of them smiling? Are they laughing? Is it just
supposed
to be a great big crowd of people?
Yeah, there's a mixture. I mean, partly their expressions are due to the process. You know, I'm adding a substance to people's faces to take the cast, so it's quite difficult to smile while that's happening. Mm-hmm. But also a lot is to do with the setting. You know, you're sort of in this completely new world. You're under this blue light. You've obviously sort of got diminished light as well, and the colors are changing. So I think that also provides some sort of somber undertones as well.
And then how long does it take for the sculpture to become covered with sea life? Because the look just, it changes dramatically. If you're looking at the pictures, it's almost, as I said earlier, otherworldly. And at times it reminds me of something from the movie series Pirates of the Caribbean, the way some of these guys look. Especially when you see coral and noses and mouths and eyes, it's beautiful and yet strange.
Yes, it's very intense.
intense,
yeah. And it happens incredibly fast as well. I'm always surprised by how sort of quickly nature colonizes it.
So what do you mean by fast?
I mean, I can put a sculpture in and almost sort of 6 days later, I'll start to see a thin film of green algae. And then the green algae will start to sort of have teeth marks on it, where all the sort of parrotfish are scraping off the algae. And then you'll see little pink sort of blotches start to appear, and those are coralline algae, and they're the kind of foundations of the reef. And then from there, it's sort of anyone's guess, and you'll have bright, sort of beautiful pink sponges, red sponges, different tunicates, fan corals, fish populations. It's every single time I go, it's always completely different.
So can anybody dive these parks?
Yes. Most of the sculptures are placed fairly shallow. The silent evolution, for example, is around 25 feet. Mm-hmm. So you can either snorkel them or dive them. In Mexico, there's two sites, a very shallow water site, which is 12 feet, which is just for snorkelers, and then the slightly deeper one at 25 feet. But it's very accessible, yes.
And is the policy hands-off when people are diving these? So what happens here isn't happening to some of the coral reefs?
Definitely, yeah. We don't encourage touching. And we've actually put signs underwater that, you know, ask people not to touch, but unfortunately they then get encrusted with coral. So it's a little bit of a process to keep that clean.
So, go ahead.
I was just saying, you know, we've had many jokes. You know, traditional museums sort of have someone seated on a chair, you know, keeping a watchful eye. You know, we don't have that luxury. So, you know, we've been trying to tame a shark to swim around and be on patrol, but again, you know, pretty unsuccessful.
Your works are some of them are whimsical. I know one of our producers was talking about the fellow who was watching TV. Are you trying to say something there? As he becomes covered with various sea life, forms of sea life?
Definitely. That particular piece is called Life's Good, and is obviously just a guy watching television. And I think that's a sort of statement about, you know, how we're all sort of maybe have tunnel vision, and we're all sort of centered on our own lives and not kind of aware of the sort of larger picture, especially regarding our environment.
And I think one of my favorites is the fellow with his head stuck in the sand.
Yes, it's interesting, actually, because I spent almost 2 years making the large installation, and it was really, really tough and really backbreaking. And, you know, I spent kind of 3 weeks making the politician with his head in the sand. And
oh, he's a politician.
Yes, yeah.
You work in metaphor, don't you?
He's quite interesting because he actually has a special area in between his trousers where eels can live inside.
Oh, isn't that funny? Okay. Well, you're talking about backbreaking work. How do you – these things have to weigh an awful lot. How much do they weigh, and how do you get them into the water?
They do weigh a lot. On average, I made a life-size Volkswagen Beetle car as well, and that was one of the heaviest, and it weighed around 8-9 tons, so that was quite a challenge to get that in.
Well, what do you do? Do you have a ship and cranes getting these things in, or do you move them in piecemeal?
Yes, we kind of make them on platforms, and then they get craned onto sort of car ferries or large-scale sort of shipping boats, and then when they reach the site, we actually crane them off the side. And then there's a team of underwater divers that will sort of locate the piece into place, and then once it's in place, we actually drill it into the seafloor so that it can't move in any kind of tropical storms or hurricanes.
Okay, so they're meant to be stable. And this, I was reading about that VW bug. That's meant to attract lobsters, right?
Yes, that has a little lobster city inside it. So it's completely hollow inside. And it has these kind of underwater apartment blocks where the lobsters would go in. And we had a little bit of a problem where the lobsters were getting sort of overfished, and we had kind of 50 of them living on the Silent Evolution, and I went there one day, and the whole 50 had sort of disappeared one night.
So, do you let people fish on your in your sculpture gardens?
No, it was done illegally. So then the idea was this car that actually had these internal spaces for the lobsters to go, and then that way they couldn't be fished because they were too difficult to access.
So, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it took a couple of years to get established, but I went back there recently, and there was over sort of 200 lobsters inside. So
okay. So, Jason, when you work with foreign governments, do they generally welcome your work? Is there a negotiation process you have to go through?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the project in Mexico was sort of initiated by the local government, by the National Marine Park, and currently I'm actually working in the Canary Islands and the Atlantic, and that's also been brought about by an art foundation, but also by the local government.
And how does your funding look? I have to imagine it's a gorgeous process, the results are beautiful, but it can't be cheap to get these things, not only put them together, but to, you know, get folks to help you get them into the water, to ship them out to the water, to use the cranes and all that stuff.
It's certainly, yeah, one of the big challenges is raising funds for the installations. And, you know, many people are strapped for cash at the moment. So, a lot of the effort goes into fundraising and applying for grants and sponsors.
You also do land sculpture. I think you alluded to that a little bit earlier in the show, that works with nature. And I love this name. Tell us about Unstill Life 2, which I think is in Greece.
Yes, yeah. That was an earlier piece, and it mirrors an underwater sculpture. So I have an Unstill Life 1, which is underwater and is growing with corals and plants and all sorts of things. And then I also made a replica on land out of stone and hollowed it out inside and put fertilizer and earth, and then planted it with local seeds and flora and fauna. So that's also sort of growing at a different rate to the underwater sculpture, but also, you know, in a sort of unique way.
Well, is this something you started when you were young? How did you get into this?
Art, you mean sculpture or the underwater side?
Well, let's talk about sculpture first. Was this something that you always saw yourself doing, and was it encouraged in your family, if so?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I sort of come from a family which has lots of artists and a lot of history of art. So it was just one of those things I sort of did in college, and it came so easy to me that I sort of knew I had to do it. But again, I sort of, it's trying to sort of, you know, convert that into a living was quite a challenge. And it took me sort of around 10 years of, you know, exploring other possibilities to actually finally find a way to make it happen.
Was there an aha moment for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was living in Grenada when I first sort of started doing this underwater work, and at first I just started off sort of making Photoshop montages of how these visions were meant to look. And then I just started actually making some small pieces and photographing them. And it just kind of just, you know, opened up this, you know, huge arena of possibility.
And your studio is now in the Canary Islands. You live a fantasy life, you realize, for a lot of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the sunshine and diving and these wonderful works. And so what is ahead for you? What's your next project, briefly?
So I've kind of just packed up my studio in Mexico and moved the family, the dogs, my daughter and everyone over to the Canary Islands. And we're sort of setting up another large-scale project here, and I've just been casting someone today, actually, and I think we've got the first 12 sculptures ready to go.
Well, Jason DeCares Taylor, it was a pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine.
Thank you so much. Jason DeCares Taylor is an artist who creates his work to sink it to form underwater sculpture parks, which also serve to help preserve and grow coral reefs. And if you want to see some of his work, check out our homepage. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll also find info about our Facebook page, podcast, Twitter, and more. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Patty McMahon, Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. I'm Radio Times. Thanks for tuning in.